And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, suicide bombing in Istanbul, plus senior Islamic State policeman beheaded in Syria. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkish authorities say one police officer was killed, another wounded after a female suicide bomber attacked a police station in Istanbul. Reports say the woman spoke English as she entered the facility and detonated the explosives, killing herself. Istanbul city governor Vasip Sahin spoke with reporters at the scene, described what investigators knew about the attack. He said they're working on the identity of the attacker and that they are not sure whether she is a Turkish citizen. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Senior figure with the self-declared police force of the Islamic State militants has been beheaded in a Syrian province. A British monitoring group told us that information on Tuesday. Meanwhile, as Saleh Hennessy reports from London, the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights also says Kurdish forces may be on the verge of recapturing a key border town from Islamic State militants.
The observatory's Rami Abdurrahman says the man, known as a senior IS police official, was found in the eastern Syrian province Deir al-Zor. He says the body displayed signs of torture and was found with a cigarette in the mouth. Abdurrahman says it's not clear who killed him. The observatory also reports that two Islamic State militants were attacked by unknown assailants in the Deir al-Zor city of Al-Mayadeen. The death and attacks come a day after Kurdish forces made major gains in the Syrian border town Kobani. Abdurrahman says fighting was ongoing Tuesday, with IS militants continuing to lose control.
They are losing again some building and some road in the southeast of the security square.
Kobani is a strategically important town on the border between Turkey and Syria, which IS fighters first attacked in September. But with support from U.S.-led airstrikes and reinforced by Kurds from Iraq, according to Abdurrahman, Kurdish fighters have taken back around 80% of the area.
Next few days, if they continue like what happened yesterday, could be that Kobani will be out of ISIS control.
Middle East expert Michael Stevens of London's Royal United Services Institute says Kobani will most likely be won back by the Kurds, but he says the Islamic State may be putting its focus elsewhere.
I think ISIS has realized that it's just not worth expending that much resources on anymore. There are bigger fish to fry. So they've concentrated their attacks in other areas where I think they have more strategic or logistical importance than a small town on the border with Turkey.
But he says the town has become an important symbol of resistance against the Islamic State, and in that respect, this is an important victory.
There is a sort of sense that the tide is turning, that ISIS are beginning to feel the pinch, but, you know, the real core operational heartlands of the Islamic State have yet to be affected. And I think until that happens, we really can't say that this is going well.
All the same, he adds, the anti-IS push is going better than it was 6 months ago. Saleh Hennessy for VOA News, London.
An Israeli military court has sentenced a Hamas militant to 3 life prison terms in connection with the murder of 3 Israeli teenagers. The court also ordered Hussam Hassan Kawasami to pay $63,000 in compensation to each of the 3 families at a hearing Tuesday. That hearing was in the West Bank city of Ramallah. Kawasami's 2 accomplices in the case were shot and killed by Israeli forces near Hebron in September. The incident heightened tensions in the region and played a major role in sparking a 50-day war between Israel and Hamas. The Gambian government's reaction to a December 30th coup attempt has been swift and unprecedented, according to human rights groups that say dozens of civilians and security personnel have been detained. The story has taken on an international dimension as well, with arrest in Senegal and the U.S. VOA's Ann Look has details.
Security remains tight in the Gambia, a week after gunmen tried to overthrow President Yahya Jammeh. Authorities are hunting for those suspected of involvement in the December 30th coup attempt. They monitor and search people at the borders and at checkpoints along the main road to the capital. Several of the alleged coup plotters are believed to have fled the country. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, are warning countries not to extradite suspects to the Gambia. Amnesty Senegal country director Sadi Gassama says it would be a, quote, scandal to extradite someone to the Gambia. Under international law and the UN Convention Against Torture, he says, you cannot extradite someone to a country where there are grounds to believe he will be tortured or could be executed extrajudicially. Rights groups initially reported that Guinea-Bissau had detained several Gambians. Guinea-Bissau said Monday that is not true. Senegal says it is expelling Gambian dissident Cheikh Sidi Abayo, a joint French-Gambian national, though it's unclear on what grounds. Rights groups say they believe Senegal will send him to France. Two American citizens of Gambian descent are being charged in the United States for their alleged roles in the coup attempt. The complaint says they were among 10 to 12 people who entered the Gambia from the United States and Britain to try to overthrow Mr. Jammeh. It's against U.S. law to conspire to take up arms against a country with whom the U.S. is at peace. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
Human Rights Watch is calling on Germany to take a leading role in the rights group's campaign to rule out the use of anti-personnel weapons in Ukraine's civilian areas. German Chancellor Angela Merkel will be meeting Thursday with Ukraine's Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. That meeting will take place in Berlin. The UN estimates the conflict in eastern Ukraine has killed 4,364 people, both soldiers and civilians on both sides. Strong currents forced Indonesia to expand the search area for the crashed Air Asia plane Tuesday as rough seas and bad weather pushed debris made it difficult to reach suspected chunks of the plane on the floor of the Java Sea, where the plane went down with 162 people on board back on December the 28th. Two more bodies were retrieved Tuesday, bringing the total to 39, but there are concerns among the searchers and others that it may be more difficult from here on to find remaining bodies from Flight 8501. The new U.S. Congress convened Tuesday, with Republicans taking control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and conservatives determined to reverse some of President Obama's policies. An anticipated Republican senator started off the new session introducing a bill to approve the controversial Keystone XL oil pipeline. Opponents, including the White House, feel it is an environmental disaster waiting to happen. Lawmakers also voted for the Speaker of House of Representatives, with incumbent John Boehner reelected to the high-profile position despite opposition from a 25-member conservative bloc within the Republican Party. Those are some of the stories making news. There's always more right here at our website, voanews.com.
This is Business News on the Voice of America.
One of these days we'll get this straight, who's supposed to start.
You do Asia, I do business.
Do business.
That's all right.
Go do the business.
Yeah, we're a team. U.S. stocks bounced off session lows by the last trading hour, but still ended Tuesday lower with losses across the board. The benchmark S&P 500 index fell for the fifth straight session. It's off more than 4% from its peak reached on December 29th of last year. Slumping oil prices and the flight to havens such as treasuries led to a bout of selling for the second consecutive day. The S&P 500 closed almost 18 points down, about 0.9% lower, to finish at 2002. The Dow Jones Industrial Average recorded another triple-digit loss, dropping 130 points, closing at 17,371. The NASDAQ composite was the hardest hit of the three. It fell nearly 60 points, 1.3%, to close at 4,592.
As they say, whatever goes up must come down. Mm. Verizon Communications is exploring a potential acquisition or joint venture with AOL Incorporated to help it expand mobile video offerings. That, according to people with knowledge of the matter, the wireless carrier hasn't made a formal proposal to AOL and no agreement is imminent, said the people, who asked not to be named because the discussions are private. Speaking at a conference on Tuesday, Verizon Chief Executive Lowell McAdam said the company is not having significant acquisition discussions and is more interested in partnerships with media companies and content providers rather than buying them.
Hollywood's home entertainment business is headed in the wrong direction again after 2 years of modest growth. Total U.S. revenue for in-home viewing of movies dropped almost 2%. According to new data from the Digital Entertainment Group Trade Association, everybody must now be listening to VOA Global. We thank you for listening to Business on VOA Global.
Coming up on VOA Global here on The Voice of America, in the American Cafe, everything isn't always perfect if you are a twin. If you have a twin brother, a twin sister, whatever, a lot of people think, oh, everything's hunky-dory, but not so much. We'll see about that. Also, people with heart problems. David Byrd will explore that. A 3D printer might be able to solve a lot of heart problems among a lot of people. Stay with us on VOA Global. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Joan Friedman understands why being a twin can often be a blessing and a curse at the same time. The psychotherapist who specializes in twins' issues is a twin herself and the mother of paternal twins. In this story, narrated by Faith Lapidus, Faiza Al-Masri tells us more on the challenges of being a twin.
When Joan Friedman and her identical twin sister Jane were growing up half a century ago, there were few twins around.
We were very much stars and got a lot of attention, and people always knew we were the Friedman twins. But then as we became older and you wanted to have your own identity, people really didn't know who we were. And it was a sense of sort of like being noticed but not being known.
Like many twins back then and even today, Joan and Jane dressed alike and were always together.
The first time Jane and I were separated was when we went to college, and it was an incredibly difficult adjustment. All of a sudden, you find yourself sort of as a very unprepared singleton.
Due to advancements in infertility treatments, Friedman says, the number of twins has grown.
Today, I think the latest statistics show that one out of every 33 births is a twin birth. And I think like in 1980s, it was one out of 90 births.
And she says, twins are often still treated as two halves of a whole rather than as separate individuals.
We've been around each other for our entire lives and, you know, we're trying to separate.
22-year-old Nazi Farkandeh and her twin sister Rana have always been inseparable best friends.
The funnest part is probably just always having a companion that you can count on. The most challenging part is just feeling that everything is kind of a shared experience when you want to have your own experience.
Farkandeh also says people perceive twins as the same person, while in fact they are very different.
Our styles are completely different. She's more of a, you know, girly girl. She likes to do her makeup. She likes to do her hair when she goes out. I'm more casual. I don't really wear any makeup, and I never do my hair. I'm more into, like, literature, and she's more into music. And even growing up, I was always a little bit more outgoing, and she was a shyer one.
Like most siblings, twins often disagree with one another.
It's really funny. It's that there's actually like a huge irony in disagreeing with your twin, because on one hand, you appreciate it because it's the way that you differentiate yourself from them. But on the other hand, it's just kind of more irritating because like somebody who's really, really, really close to you disagreeing with you. So in that sense, it kind of burns more.
Twin boys process their differences differently than twin girls, says psychotherapist Joan Friedman.
Identical twin girls have the closest relationships just because girls tend to need and find, you know, more intimacy with one another. Identical twin girls really do try to keep the competition under wraps, whereas boys will be able to express their feelings or their hostility in a more open way.
In her new book, The Same But Different, How Twins Can Live, Love, and Learn to Be Individuals, Friedman offers this advice for raising independent twins.
I have certain things that I always tell parents, which is, of course, not to dress them alike and not to give them alliterative names like, you know, Tom and Tony and Natalie and Nancy, but to give them different names. Make sure you take separate pictures of each twin. If they grow up and never see a picture of themselves by themselves, it's very difficult for them to think about them as separate.
Reinforcing different personalities and nurturing different temperaments, Joan Friedman says, is key to raising happy, close twins who have their own individual goals and paths in life. For writer Faiza Al-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Your invitation is out. Every day you can hear this program and join us in the cafe at voanews.com and on many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. You know, 3D printing has been used to make all kinds of things. Architectural models, toys, tools, even firearms. But now, it can help surgeons fix heart problems by making an exact replica of a diseased heart so they can look at the problem before they operate. Roseanne Skirbel tells us more.
Surgeons routinely use digital images to explore the heart in minute detail. But no two human hearts are alike, which led Matthew Bramlett to create an exact heart replica from those images. The University of Illinois College of Medicine pediatric cardiologist says the 3D replica uncovers information to guide surgery.
Even when, you know, I will take the MRI and render the images, even a heart that's printing or that's, you know, sort of spinning on the screen, it's still a 2D screen. And so what we've done with the printed models, we pull it out of the screen so that you can actually hold it in your hand and evaluate the anatomy sort of for the first time in a manner that makes sense and is logical.
Here's how it works. A CT scan, MRI, and other data are sent to a 3D printer to replicate a heart in a plaster or ceramic mold. The printer then constructs the heart thin layer by thin layer. Bramlett says the model matches the real heart in every detail.
When we're done with the model and we've made our decision, we want to be able to go back to the heart model or the source image and confirm those findings.
Bramlett has built model hearts for various procedures, all with successful outcomes. In one case, digital images showed a tiny hole in a baby's heart. Yet the 3D printed model revealed multiple holes, defects the baby was born with, and not readily apparent in the images.
Knowing that it was there, we could still not demonstrate it. And sure enough, he went in and was able to confirm it and change the surgery. But that saved ischemic time. Well, in the future, you know, relying on that information would allow us to, you know, not even have to stop the heart to sort of go down the alternative pathway.
Bramlett came to a recent American Heart Association meeting with a prop, a 3D printed baby's heart.
This is a very small, if you look at it, this is, you know, about the size of an egg. And this is the baby's heart. And to me, you know, I know the surgeons do amazing work, but when I sit here and I look and see this BT shunt and how small it is and how it's attached, it still baffles my mind that the surgeons are able to do the things that they do.
Kathy Magliotto is a cardiac surgeon at St. John's Health Center in Los Angeles. Speaking by Skype, she said she welcomes the 3D model, saying it can help surgeons make better decisions before they operate.
The fact that I can then take this very complicated structure, which has just an endless possibilities of what it could look like anatomically when I open the body, and you give it to me before the operation, that I can hold it in my hand and plan an operation around what I'm seeing, touching, and feeling, that to me is what can potentially change the game on an operation and save lives.
Matthew Bramlett continues to explore the technology. He's partnered with the National Institutes of Health to build a 3D reference library that includes models and images that others can learn from. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, curators from the Smithsonian also used 3D printing to make a bust of President Barack Obama. Gunter Wabel is the Smithsonian's director of the Digitization Program Office. He said in a White House video that his crew was inspired by plaster life masks made of former President Abraham Lincoln.
And seeing that made us think, what would have happened if we could actually do that with a sitting president, using modern day technologies and tools to create a similarly authentic experience that connects us to history, to connects us to a moment in time, and connects us to a person's likeness.
The bust is on display at the Smithsonian here in Washington. If you would like to learn more about that process, log on to www.whitehouse.gov and search 3D print. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
All right, one of the big questions in the United States, at least for sports fans, is which is the bigger sport, baseball or football?
More people see baseball than they do football.
Yeah, but there are a lot more games throughout the season, so they have more opportunity. Football, though.
Yeah, the trends are with football, with American football, the NFL especially, the top TV ratings, sold-out stadiums for the most part, and baseball, TV ratings for the World Series are down.
And then there's the Super Bowl, too, which really throws in football's favor.
Big story on baseball coming up now. This is sports on VOA Global. Now we start with baseball. Randy Johnson, winner of 5 Cy Young Awards as his league's top pitcher, was elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame along with 3 other former Major League players in voting results announced Tuesday. Fellow pitchers Pedro Martinez and John Smoltz and versatile hitter Craig Biggio were also elected to the Baseball Shrine in Cooperstown, New York, in balloting by the Baseball Writers Association of America. This was the largest number of players voted into the Hall of Fame since the class of 1955, when Joe DiMaggio, Gabby Hartnett, Ted Lyons, and Desi Vance were inducted.
In the National Basketball Association, the Cleveland Cavaliers, Oklahoma City Thunder, and New York Knicks completed a 3-team trade involving 6 players Monday, with the injury-hit Cavs acquiring guards Iman Shumpert and J.R. Smith from the Knicks. Cleveland announced they had also received a protected 2015 first-round pick from the Thunder. In turn, the Cavs sent guard Deion Waiters to the Thunder and Lou Amundsen and Alex Kirk to the Knicks. Cleveland also sent a 2019 second-round draft pick to New York. If you can keep track of all of that, the Knicks, out of the playoff contention, also got forward Lance Thomas from Oklahoma City.
You will be tested on this, so make sure you write everything down, because I have no idea what that's all about. Rafael Nadal's ability to make a quick recovery from multiple ailments in tennis was thrown into doubt Tuesday as he lost 1-6, 6-3, 6-4 to Michael Barrera in Qatar. This first-round match was Nadal's first match of the 2015 ATP World Tour, and he appeared to have had insufficient time to recover from an appendectomy and far too little match practice over the past 2 months.
World number one Serena Williams complained of tiredness after being trounced by Canadian Eugenie Bouchard at the mixed team Hopman Cup on Tuesday. Williams was humbled by the 6th-ranked Bouchard in straight sets as Canada upset the tournament favorites 2-1. You know, she got some coffee a day earlier in her match and won it. Perhaps she didn't get her coffee for that match.
Well, I read a little bit, and it said that she did not ask for any more espresso like she did the other day. So who knows? When the Australian Open opens next week or so, we'll see if coffee is on the menu. That's sports from the Voice of America. And it's time for music now here on The Voice of America. While overall album sales were down again in 2014, vinyl album sales were a bright spot in an otherwise generally bleak sales picture. Sales of the configuration grew by 52% in 2014 to 9.2 million copies. For the 7th straight year, more vinyl albums were sold than in any other year since Nielsen started tracking music sales since 1991. Top-selling vinyl album of 2014 is also the top-selling vinyl album of any calendar year in the Nielsen era, Jack White's Lazaretto, with 87,000. You want to listen to it? Go ahead. I don't have that album.
I don't either.
I don't think I want that album.
Nice.
But nevertheless, it's the way it is. Do you have albums?
I have a ton of albums.
I don't know what happened to all
mine. I've got, believe me, over the years, I've got tons of vinyl. In fact, I'm trying to get rid of my vinyl now. It's all digitized.
Just write to Jim Stevens.
Yes.
No, we're not allowed to do that, are we?
We can't.
I don't think we can. But nevertheless, I just found a I haven't had a turntable for years.
Well, then that is a hindrance to listening to vinyl.
Yeah. I don't know if you listen to vinyl, but apparently, from what we just told you, the popularity is growing for vinyl records again.
This
VOA
is VOA Global.
See, this
yes.
is the third time we've done this.
Yeah, but it's in stereo, right?
That is correct. Yes, it is in stereo. However, there an Arizona agency's posting about Bigfoot is leaving its mark on social media. The Arizona Department of Transportation Facebook post from January 1st reads, "We might have spotted a family of Sasquatches on State Route 260 near Herber this afternoon. What do you think?"
That's David's line.
Yes, it is. Accompanying is a couple of traffic camera photos showing a blurry cluster of figures on the side of the road. As of Tuesday, it had been shared with more than 3,700 people and had nearly 1,000 comments. Spokesman Terry Herman says his agency tries to drive traffic to its Twitter account using humor, a strategy that has helped them gain nearly 52,000.
You know what, though?
What?
The mysterious figures haven't budged in days, and that leads them to believe that they might be something a lot more down-to-earth than the original post suggests, something like shrubbery?
Possibility. I saw one of the pictures, and it sure does look like something that could be Sasquatch.
Yeah, right.
I don't know, or it could be. You know, maybe they're of such high intelligence that they knew they were being photographed.
That's right.
And just said, "Stay still."
Maybe it's like deer in the headlights.
Looked like
you know?
A tree.
They just stopped and froze, and maybe nobody would notice them.
Well, they were furry, and they kind of looked like Sasquatches, whatever a Sasquatch is supposed to
look like.
I
thought that was a vegetable.
And you never ate a Sasquatch. Our thanks to Tracy Carter, our director, and Carl Starling has been pushing the buttons.
Thank you.
And Diane Gal has been overseeing everything, waiting to critique everything that we do. So have yourself a wonderful day.
Please come back tomorrow.